From WXXI News, this is a Connections. This is Connections. This is an episode of Connections, and I'm still just Evan Dawson. Oh, it's a Monday, everybody, and I have a scenario I want you to think about. First of all, can you think of the best boss you ever had? Is there someone who immediately comes to mind? I would hope so, but if it's difficult to think of anybody, that might be indicative of what we're doing in our society. And then let me paint a little scenario for you. How about this? A departure at a company of a star employee. A star employee is leaving an organization after about 5 years. Many of her coworkers thought she was on a fast track to the top. People respect her. They respect her work. They appreciate how she treats her colleagues. So how, they wonder, are we losing her? What has happened here? Here's a way of thinking about it that I admit I had not really considered before. When people leave companies or when people leave organizations, they're often not really leaving the company or the organization. They're leaving a bad boss. That's the argument made by Stephen Covey in his book, Trust and Inspire, How Truly Great Leaders Unleash Greatness in Others. Covey writes about the impact of poor leadership, of bad bosses, essentially, the effect they can have on talented people who might otherwise want to stay. But we often don't talk about it that way. It's like, well, they're leaving. They're leaving the company. Too bad they're losing this person. Why do we frame it that way? Maybe it's convenient, I guess. But the reality might be simpler. It's often harder to change, though. After all, there's a whole lot of my way or the highway leadership out there, command and control instead of trust and inspire. Why do so many executives do it that way? Have you ever wondered that? You ever thought to yourself, how did this person get to be a boss? And there's probably obvious answers to that. Maybe people are good at the bottom line, but are they good at managing people? Well, Covey writes that we've entered an era in which that kind of leadership doesn't really work anymore, and it has to change. He also writes that when he brings this approach to organizations, here's what happens. They all say, this is great. But then he talks to an executive, and they go, this is great for everybody else. I already have this down, but you should talk to our CEO. Then he talks to the CEO, and the CEO goes, this is great, but I'm already this way. You should talk to our board. And our board goes, this is great, but have you talked to our CFO yet? And everybody passes the buck. Everybody sort of thinks that they're doing it right. Covey is challenging executives, leaders, to be better leaders and to understand that you can give up a little bit of that sense of control without having a totally disheveled organization. It's a really interesting way of thinking about it, and the question is, can it work? Stephen M. R. Covey is the author of several books, including Trust and Inspire, How Truly Great Leaders Unleash the Greatness in Others. He's on the line with us. Stephen, welcome. Thanks for making time for the program.
Hi. Great to be with you, Evan. Excited to be on the show.
Nice to have you, and nice to have with us in studio, Bob Whipple is the CEO of Leader Grow Incorporated, a member of the Rochester Rotary. He's known as the Trust Ambassador. That's a good ambassadorship to get, by the way. Welcome back to the program, Bob.
Thank you. Thank you, Evan.
And great to have with us Kathleen Pringle, who's an executive coach, a career strategist, and currently the president of the Rochester Rotary. It's a one-year term, thank goodness for Kathleen, because it's a lot of work, and they have a lot going on. In fact, in a couple of weeks, they are bringing Stephen M. R. Covey here. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
What's great coming up on April 11th?
April 11th, we've got Stephen M. R. Covey coming to Rochester, to the convention center. We are sold out of VIP seats, and we've got another week left here through Saturday to purchase individual tickets or tables, and you can go to rochesterrotary.org and scoop those up before they're gone.
All right, rochesterrotary.org for more information here. Bob, what does this event mean to Rotary, and what's it about to you here?
Well, this is really a continuation of our celebration of the 100th year of the Sunshine Camp. We celebrated it last year, and this became a more convenient date for Stephen and for us to do it, so we're doing it now. But we're very, very excited. I brought Stephen here in 2008 when his first book was published, The Speed of Trust, and he did such a wonderful job that everybody's still talking about it and still passing around the cards that he gave us. And so I'm definitely looking forward to having lightning strike in the same place.
Well, and Kathleen's holding up some of your work as well here. Stephen, it's great to have you. And can you give us a kind of an overview, and then we're going to kind of drill into how you approach the question of leadership and how you'd like executives to do it. But can you give us the overview of why now you think that we've entered this era where the old models don't really work anymore?
Yes, absolutely. Our world has changed and is changing around us right now in front of our eyes in so many different ways. And yet, while the world is changing, our style of leadership kind of has not. We kind of it's coming out of that old model. It's just we become a little bit more advanced and then sophisticated in it. I call it an enlightened command and control, as opposed to the authoritarian command and control. And yet, it's not going to really work in this new world where we have as many as five generations at work. And these younger generations, you know, Gen Z, millennials, and this upcoming alpha generation, they have completely different expectations of how they want to be engaged. They won't tolerate the old model of leadership very well. And they want to be engaged differently. We've got, you know, the workplace is changing as well, where suddenly there's work from home or hybrid work or intentionally flexible work options that didn't exist really that much just a few years ago. And then technology is changing everything. And suddenly people have choices and options in a way that they didn't have before. And so when people feel like they're just being kind of managed and controlled and they're asking the question, kind of like you did in the introduction, of why do I want to be here if they don't trust me, if they're just going to manage me and tell me what to do, why'd they hire me? And so they often leave or they become disengaged and we're not tapping into their potential and their talent. The world has changed. Our style of leadership needs to catch up with it. And the old model, command and control, is just not going to produce the kind of speed, the kind of flexibility, the kind of collaboration, innovation to stay relevant in this changing world. And above all, what it won't do is it won't engage and inspire our people. It's just not going to do it anymore. You can't command and control your way to a high trust culture that inspires. We've got to lead in a new way.
Stephen, I want to talk to you about what you hear from executives who may resist a little, or maybe there's kind of a generational divide. And just a little background there. I mean, I think it's probably inevitable that every generation that enters the workforce brings slightly different values or updated values from what their parents sort of grew up with, different ways of looking at things. And there are times where I have felt, as I get a little bit older myself, sometimes I think, man, where's the work ethic? Does anybody have a work ethic anymore? And then I resist that because I go, no, that's baloney. And so much of what younger workers are doing is trying to get us to see how the system has been poorly structured or disadvantaged or given too much tilting in favor of others and unnecessarily. And I think a lot of that is justified. It is wise. It's admirable. But I know that you must have executives who go, oh, kids these days, like, you know, like they want to walk right in and they want the whole store right off the bat. They don't want to work for it. I know you must hear that. And they probably tell you, look, don't fall prey to that. Like they need firm leadership. They need the discipline. They need a discipline for a work ethic. I'm sure you hear that. What do you say to that?
Yeah. I say, you know what? You both could be right. I mean, seriously, the senior executives could be right if we expect and want a work ethic, but also the younger generations could be right that they want to be trusted. So I use as an example, the idea, is trust earned or is trust given? And if you think about it, and the older generations, you know, traditionalists and the like, they tend to start from the premise that trust is earned. You got to earn trust. And the younger generations tend to start from the premise of trusting is given.
Yeah.
You get trust.
Absolutely.
And guess what? Guess what? They're both right, because trust is earned, but it's also given. And so it's not so much which is right or wrong. It's an and approach, but it's trying to meet people where they're at. It's just trying to be relevant. And ultimately, you know, trust is both earned and given, but sometimes the very act of giving the trust is what is going to enable people to learn to earn the trust. So it can go in both directions, but we've got to stay relevant in a changing world, and to kind of continue to operate with the old model, it's just not going to produce the kind of outcomes that we need in a new world of work where people have choices and options, because they'll leave. They'll go elsewhere.
Yeah.
If they don't feel trusted and inspired. And so that's what's the opportunity in front of all of us as leaders.
I have a concept that I call the first law of trust. And that is, if you're a leader, if you're not happy with the level of trust you're seeing, what you need to do is learn to extend more trust to others, because extending trust gets trust back.
Mm-hmm. That's hard for some, though, Bob. I mean, we've all had bosses. I'm glad to say I don't feel that way right now. That's not just me. I'm on a microphone. Be careful, Evan. What are you saying about your exec? No. This is a very healthy situation at XXI, but we've all been there, Bob, where we can think of bosses you've had and you go, boy, I'm glad I'm not, you know, dealing with that anymore, because what you're describing never happens. It's this my way or the highway. Mm-hmm. I've heard a boss say, you know, if you think morale is bad here, there's the door. Someone else will do your job if you won't. Literally said that in a meeting, and we all were like, wow, that's inspiring. So why is it so hard for some, you think?
So the problem is, for many years it worked. For decades, yeah, it worked. And it was a way to lead that got behaviors that worked. No longer is that the case. People are not willing to tolerate being hounded and being watched and all those kinds of things that are going on in many organizations today.
Kathleen, I think what is surprising to a lot of executives now is how quickly younger workers will just pull the plug and get out, sometimes without 2 weeks' notice, sometimes not even with a phone call. Mm-hmm. But if they feel disrespected, if they feel like they're not valued, they're not waiting around as much as previous generations, even if they're in sort of tenuous financial circumstances. I think that's caught executives off guard. What do you think?
I do agree. And I think that the way you get in front of that is as part of the hiring and selection process, whether it's through human resources or even the hiring manager or just the collective team, is that, you know, it's incumbent upon an employer to really have the conversation with people about what is our culture about, what do we stand for, what do we tolerate, what do we encourage, and at the same time, to really, like what Stephen M. R. Covey just said a few minutes ago about meeting people where they're at, it's about also understanding why someone is there. You know what? Why is it that you're here? What is it that you expect? And making certain that we can forge some mutual purpose, which will engender some trust.
I also think, I kind of skipped to the ending of Steve's book in my introduction when I said, he finds when he travels, executives go, this is great, but I have this figured out already. You need to go talk to somebody else in my office. And it's this pass the buck thing. Do you think, Kathleen, that most executives would agree that they could benefit from this kind of approach? Or do you think most people think they've got it figured out?
When they don't think they can benefit, I call that CEO disease. Like, you know what, I've got it all figured out. Yeah. But I think that, or C-level disease. I think that with everything that everybody's gone through in the last few years, and, you know, there's an old saying, you know, when the tide goes out, you find out whose trunks are down. Well, I think that what happened is that, you know, all of a sudden everybody went home 3 years ago, and a lot of leaders needed to repurpose their value. Gee, I don't have people in my midst every day that I'm talking to, that I'm seeing, so now I have to learn a whole new skill set on how to manage distributed teams. And that requires a different level of trust in self, capability, and in others from a distance. And so everybody's been through this evolution, but as people are coming back to work, I know this from a couple of weeks ago. I spoke in front of a group and had a raise of hands. How many of you are back? And overwhelmingly, in an audience of almost 500, almost everybody was back.
In the office.
In the office.
Yeah.
And not just minimum 3 days a week, but people are back in the office. And I think some new norms are being set, but it just takes certain people longer. And it's really about understanding, what is my role and what am I really responsible for? And that's the whole thing about this new trust and inspire way of leadership, which Stephen will be talking to us about on April 11th.
Yeah. Bob, do you think most executives, if you give them Stephen's book, they go, this is great. I know someone who needs it. It's not me.
I've worked with really literally hundreds of leaders in our community over the years, and I have only one time heard the following phrase. Only once has a leader said to me, you know, we're pretty messed up in here in our culture, and since I'm in charge, it must be originating with me. Once I heard that. In other words, they don't see it. They don't see themselves as the originator, really, of the problems that they're experiencing.
Yeah, but a lot would probably tell you, yeah, we've got morale issues. But then it's always like, that's because people are lazy.
Yeah. Like, it's like, that's because they don't do this.
Yeah, it's somebody else's fault, yeah. Always. So, Stephen, can you kind of weigh in on that idea that people love this idea, but they often want to share it with somebody else instead of internalize it?
Yeah, it's probably the most common response, which is, like you were saying, great idea, love it. Just wish my boss were here right now to hear this, because she really needs it, or my colleague or my peer or my people. You know, it's easy to point the finger out there. But, you know, to Bob's point, we've got to look in the mirror, each of us. And if you think that the problem is out there, is everybody else, that very thinking is the problem, because we've disempowered ourselves. And that's the common approach. And so when I talk about trust and inspire, most people kind of say, yeah, I kind of do this. I got this down. And I like to say that the first barrier to becoming a trust and inspire leader is that we think we already are one, when we're probably not quite as far along on the journey that, you know, we might imagine that we are. So becoming self-aware, looking in the mirror, starting with ourselves is vital, and not just kind of saying, yeah, I get this. I got this. I'm doing this. When the question is that what people are experiencing from their perspective from you?
I want you to define command and control leadership, because we use that term. What does it mean?
Yeah, it's the traditional kind of top-down, more hierarchical, more, you were saying it, my way or the highway. Now, what's happened is we're more sophisticated about it. We don't express it in quite those terms. You know, it's become an enlightened command and control, but it's managing people and things. I think the best way to describe command and control is to contrast it to trust and inspire. See, trust and inspire, in that you manage things, but you lead people. And we need good management. We need good management of things, of systems, of processes, of structures, of strategies, of inventories, of finances. You manage the business, but you lead people. And the moment we start to manage people as if they were things, we're going to end up with not very many people and a lot of things, because they'll leave, they'll go elsewhere. People don't want to be managed. People want to be led. They want to be trusted. They want to be inspired. So the old model is more the traditional hierarchical, position-based, you know, of directing and just giving out the orders, barking the orders, versus truly seeing the potential, the greatness is inside of people. Also, one last point, under the command and control model, the result is, you know, heavily on the outcomes, which is a good thing. We need outcomes. But people are more just the means to the end of achieving the outcomes. So we try to get results through people, which doesn't sound so bad, but people are just the means to an end. In Trust and Inspire, by contrast, we still have to focus on the results. We're trying to get results, but we're trying to do it in a way that grows people, that develops people, that builds trust in the culture. And that is as important as the results themselves, the people. We elevate people to the level of results and performance, their development, their growth. And then that inspires them. The study from McKinsey shows that the number one reason why people leave is because they're not growing and developing. It's not pay. That's up there, but it's not pay. It's they're not growing and developing, and they don't feel trusted. Mm-hmm.
And what most senior leaders fail to see is the productivity multiplier that you get when you get that kind of engagement. It's at least two times. I've seen it happen so many times that okay, people get inspired and they take off and they rise to their potential and they feel great about it. And it's a completely different environment or atmosphere.
And to Bob's point, they actually perform better. So the very thing that they want, performance, they're getting it. But not only do the people perform better, but they're happier, have greater well-being. So every arrow goes in the right direction that you want.
I want to read from a passage from Stephen's book that I confess it. I think there's a parallel, and I'll explain here. But this is from a case study looking at Blockbuster Video. So most people remember Blockbuster Video now. My son wouldn't. He would find that very strange. But it was a real thing. And I'm going to read from the book here, because this is part of what Stephen is doing to illustrate in his book that if you take this command and control leadership approach, it's not just that your employees might sort of be miserable or not like you. It's that you don't trust them enough and you don't hear the ideas. And then you may miss a big, big chance to pivot. And all of a sudden, you're Blockbuster Video. So let me read from the book here. Blockbuster Video is a simple illustration of nothing fails like success. At its peak in 2000, Blockbuster was extremely successful. 84,000 employees worked in 9,000 stores, producing nearly $6 billion in revenue while serving 65 million customers all over the world. At the time, almost everyone who watched movies at home rented them from stores. Then the technology started to shift. Instead of having to go to a store to rent a movie, customers could get DVDs in the mail through a new entrepreneurial company called Netflix. Blockbuster was slow to the game, having previously turned down the chance to buy Netflix and then again to partner with Netflix. Next came streaming movies over the internet. The new business model Netflix utilized was a subscription service, first by mail, then streaming. No late fees were charged. Again, Blockbuster was slow to respond to the new challenge. They were afraid of cannibalizing themselves. They wanted to protect their previously successful business model of video rentals through their 9,000 stores, and they wanted to continue to collect late fees when people didn't return their videos on time. By the time Blockbuster finally responded to the changing way of doing things, it was way too late. Today, Blockbuster has only one store in Bend, Oregon, and it is quite literally a relic of the past, end quote. I didn't even know it has that one store. That was interesting to me. But I got to say, let me tell our guests in studio, I'm sitting here looking at Kodak across the street. Could that not have been Kodak, Bob Whipple?
It was. Absolutely.
The Blockbuster story is the Kodak story.
Absolutely.
Isn't it?
Absolutely was.
I mean, you got to be thinking the
same
thing.
Everybody thought that film was the purple cow, and obviously it was not.
Even when digital came, they're like, well, if we go digital, then it's going to hurt our film business,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, that's a strategy. And I don't know what the leadership was like inside Kodak. I mean, I've read books and seen interviewed people, but I'm not up to speed. I don't remember every CEO at every point. I just bring that up, Stephen, because it's an indication that you're not just talking about be kinder for kinder sake, which is great, by the way. Being kind is good. But you're also, it's a different kind of leadership that doesn't miss the chance to trust your employees to help you turn the company when you're going over a cliff, kind of. Is that fair?
Absolutely. This is all part of this idea that the world is changing right in front of our eyes.
I used to work for the one of the chief technology people at Kodak. And I remember the day when he came back. Kodak invented digital photography.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when he came back from a board meeting where he presented that this is the new thing, he had a digital camera with him. This is 10 years before the thing. And the board refused to invest in that. And he was turned down. He was so chagrined.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason Blockbuster isn't fully Kodak is Blockbuster would have had to invent Netflix and then say, let's just keep that under wraps because we prefer our stores. Because that's basically what Kodak did. But why do we do it this way, Stephen?
Well, it's because that we're still entrenched in the old model, and we're not in a cult. We haven't built this culture of authenticity and openness and real collaboration, which leads to innovation. And we're too afraid to take a risk, to make a mistake, to learn. So we're trying to protect. And that's kind of, again, the old model. And you see very little innovation coming from mm-hmm. lower trust companies. Mm-hmm. Why? Because people are afraid to take a risk and make a mistake and fail and learn from that failure. It's too limiting, career ending to take a risk and make a mistake. And it's because there's low trust. But in the high trust cultures, the data shows that people are 32 times more likely to take a responsible risk, and they're 11 times more likely to innovate. And you just won't see that in the low trust culture. And so when this change is happening, it requires us to kind of be able to respond, not just with what's worked in the past, but what's going to maybe work going forward. But that's a little bit risky, and you won't do that when there's low trust. That's why trust is the foundation of both collaboration and innovation. And command and control doesn't produce trust.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about the AI age that we're entering and the broad range of predictions on how much job disruption there's going to be. But the bottom line is, if that is a rigid company that you're in without much innovating going on, without much forward looking going on, we're all going to be Kodak and Blockbuster, because it's going to be a jaw dropping how many jobs can be gone. Or how, everybody knows I'm an AI curmudgeon, but I mean, it's coming. So can you use it in a way that augments, that allows for creativity, or is it just going to take your job? I don't know. Kathleen, what do you tell people as an executive coach? You tell people, well, you know, AI is probably taking your job, so, you know, just build a nice raft and head out to an island. You probably don't say that.
No, I do not. And I think, again, it's all about value, about understanding how it is that you can promote and deliver your own value based on what it is that you are responsible and accountable for. And so, you know, I think as leaders, we all have to model that behavior if we expect to beget that. And to Stephen's point, you know, in high trust environments, creativity can flourish. And that's because there's psychological safety in the environment to be able to take risks. And people are not operating from a place of self-preservation. And so when you look at technology, we all have to be thinking that, you know, at some point there will be something disruptive that could lead any individual or company, product, service into obsolescence. So we always have to be thinking, forward thinking about, like, okay, how do we stay ahead of that? Well, we do that by not staying in a silo or in a vacuum, but by collaborating. And you can collaborate more easily when there's trust in the environment.
Well, I've got to take a phone call. And listeners, if you want to weigh in on your bad boss stories or your thoughts, maybe you're an executive and you're rethinking about how you do things. Or maybe you know someone who's an executive in your life and you'd like them to rethink about how they do things. The book we're talking about is called Trust and Inspire: How Truly Great Leaders Unleash Greatness in Others. The author, Stephen M. R. Covey, is on the line with us, and he's coming to Rochester as a guest of Rochester Rotary on April 11th, rochesterrotary.org, the website. A lot more information there. They would love to see you there. This is Keith and Victor on the phone. Hi, Keith. Go ahead.
Evan, for being an old guy, what really perpetuates poor or bad bosses and poor management are basically a list of benefits that a company would supply. There used to be a time where you were more inclined to put up with it because they had fully paid health care, or they had excellent health care, or some of the benefits were good. When you can compare the American system with the of capitalism, per se, with the rest of the industrialized world, the employees don't have to worry about health care from one employer to the other, or benefits, because I believe if you're an EU member, your employees get 6 weeks of vacation a year, other than maybe a teacher. That's a rarity in this country.
So you see a difference in Europe and United States on this issue, for example?
Oh, my goodness, it's black and white.
Okay.
We're a form of capitalism where you put business first and then the employees. On a socialist side, you put the employees first and then the business. But if you have happy employees, you're going to have successful businesses.
Yeah, and I'm not sure.
I mean, one is Ducati.
And it's not just pure socialism you're looking at over there, Keith. I mean,
Of
course. I mean, like, and even in Scandinavia, that gets a lot of praise. Denmark gets a lot of praise for being a very innovative. They score high in the form of innovation, worker satisfaction, and yet social safety nets. So, I mean, it's not pure socialism, but you're saying it's a slightly different system and a different approach to how businesses run.
Right. And just by having good employees, it's going to trickle down to the management. If you don't have the turnover, if your employees are happy, guess what? You're going to have a good work environment. Your management's going to be happy. It's a win-win situation. But we don't look at it like that in this country. I spent a little time in Norway, and they pay a huge tax rate, but they had cradle-to-grave help if they needed it. If they had a newborn, and they needed, had to work for because of their job, say they were a doctor, a nurse, or something like that, you had support from the government to help you. If you had a grandmother that had dementia, you had support. But people don't look at it like this in this country. But they also don't look at what you pay in total tax amount when you go from property tax to school tax to excise taxes, et cetera, et cetera. And if you have a bad management at a company, it's just going to perpetuate if employees don't turn over.
Keith, thank you. Let me ask all three of our guests. Stephen M. R. Covey, you want to respond first? What do you think?
Well, clearly, you know, they are different systems to some degree. And the point, if I understand Keith is making, includes that, let's say, the economic setup can be different in different countries and societies. There's merit to that. And I think this is a foundation of it. What I would just add, though, that's a little bit different, is that that alone, taking care of the person economically, is only one of the needs that they have that's especially been manifest today. Yes, they have a body, but people also have a heart and a mind and a spirit. So yes, they want to be paid and paid fairly and have a good economic setup. That will motivate them. But what's going to inspire them is that they have a heart, so they want to connect. I love the name of this show, Connections. They want to connect with people through a sense of caring and a sense of belonging on this team. And, you know, caring and belonging help inspire. They also want to, they have a mind, so they want to grow and develop and contribute. Again, the number one reason people leave, according to McKinsey study, is that they're not growing and developing. And then they have a spirit. They want to matter, to make a difference, to leave a legacy, to have purpose and meaning and contribution in the work that they're doing. So body, heart, mind, spirit, they're a whole person, not just an economic being only. I'm not downplaying the economic, because in the hierarchy of needs, it comes first. But in addition to that, we can go so much further if we not only see people as, you know, mouths to be fed, but as they have a heart and mind and spirit, they can contribute in so many profound ways. Let's tap into that to unleash the potential, the greatness, the talent that's inside of them. And it will come back multifold to us because of how they perform better and how they're happier.
What do you think, Bob Whipple?
Well, I'm completely agreeing with Stephen, of course. In my career, I've been successful several times at being able to unleash the power that's been blocked. And I can't take the time to tell the stories, but the difference is absolutely unbelievable. And I think back of those things as the high points of my career, when I was able to take someone who was really quite negative or really quite sick, really, and it wasn't their fault, it was the fault of the structure that we had. So when I was able to understand what was going on and change it and turn it around, that what Stephen would say is unleashed that person, and amazing things happen when you do that.
Kathleen?
It's true. So just on a fundamental level, we are human beings. We are not human doings, which speaks to what Stephen was saying about mind, body, heart, and about purpose. I really truly believe that no matter what generation, as human beings, we all need to lead with our why and our purpose. And when leaders, managers start to really understand what matters to people, and they can link those things to what it is that they're responsible for, creativity, innovation, collaboration, trust, it all is part of the mix, and it all will turn into great things. I've had the opportunity in my own career to be managed by, frankly, some of the best, and the other way, too. And there's such a difference. I you know, that discretionary effort when someone is given the opportunity to just grow, take risk, and be able to, you know what, make a contribution is amazing. And when people have a thumb on them and it's all about what you're not doing right and just do what it is that's expected and work as a means to an end, that's when, like Stephen said, people leave.
And imagine the power, the difference in power. If we're talking about an individual here, we can see it very mm-hmm. clearly on an individual basis. But if you can change the whole culture mm-hmm. Of a group, oh my goodness, it's just the thing takes off like a rocket. and you can't stop it. And it's just beautiful to see.
Well, we have to take this only break. As we go to break, I'll just read Dan emails to say, the conversation on Kodak reminded me that when I was at RIT, I applied to Kodak for an internship. During the interview, I was asked a standard question. Why did I want to intern at Kodak? Part of my answer was, so I could make mistakes and then learn from them. Well, the interviewer thought I had two heads or something and was totally aghast at my answer. Needless to say, I did not get the internship. Actually, that's a great answer, Dan. I love that answer. And our guests have been talking about the value of innovating, the trust that that goes both ways. The trust that says if you make a mistake and you're making a real effort and you know it's honest intention, that mistake may help us. That may help you grow. You don't have to be scared of making a mistake. Everybody makes mistakes. So, Dan, I appreciate that email. I wish I were more surprised by it. But we're talking about Stephen M. R. Covey's book, Trust and Inspire, How Truly Great Leaders Unleash Greatness in Others. He is on the line with us. And from Rochester Rotary, Kathleen Pringle is the president of Rochester Rotary and an executive coach and career strategist. And Bob Whipple is a member of Rotary, CEO of Leader Grow Incorporated. And they're helping bring Stephen here for an event on April 11th. They would love to see you there, rochesterrotary.org. I've got more of your emails to read as we talk about good and bad leadership on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections. We've heard a lot from the scientific community about climate change and what we are facing. What are we teaching in classrooms? How does climate change fit into the curriculum? How has that changed in New York State or elsewhere? We'll talk to some of the experts in the field on climate change curriculum Tuesday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield, with a mission to address health inequities by building up communities and breaking down health barriers. Excellus Blue Cross Blue Shield, everybody benefits. More at excellusbcbs.com.
This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This question comes from Rich, and Stephen's going to clear up, just in case you hear Stephen Covey, and you might know Stephen M. R. Covey, and you might know a different Stephen Covey. Rich says, first, I want to say that Mr. Covey's book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, has been one of the most important books I have ever read to help people reach personal goals. Different Stephen, but we're going to explain in a second, but that's still a great book and totally understandable, Rich. And then Rich wants to know, can Mr. Covey address how we can move from discussions to actual problem solving? Although the discussion is about employers and corporations, so much of what you're talking about can be applied to the many serious problems affecting our world. But how do you actually get to problem solving? So, Stephen M. R. Covey, you want to address those points?
Sure. Sure. On the first point, the book, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, was written by my father, who's the original Stephen Covey, Stephen R. Covey. And he passed away about a decade ago. I helped him kind of turn that book into the business, the Covey Leadership Center that became Franklin Covey. So I was involved with that from the beginning, which was exciting. But obviously, I'm building on that. I'm standing on the shoulder of a giant in my father. So that book is foundational to everything I've been doing. And I'm his son, Stephen M. R. Covey, different middle initials. And my work has been on trust, the speed of trust, trust and inspire. So that's a little clarity, but I love that my father's work continues to impact people everywhere, which is very exciting. And
now,
it's really
now how do you take these examples that Rich is talking about that he's been hearing and apply them? Because he says it goes beyond just a company structure. There's so many questions of bad leadership in the world and why we are seeing sometimes a crisis come up, in whether it's government or in different sort of social circles, society. How do we actually get action out of this instead of just discussion, Stephen?
Yeah. No, this is a big, big challenge and opportunity for us. And I think this is where organizations and businesses can maybe lead out and be a model of what's possible, to have real dialogue where people see the world differently, and yet where they can have understanding to that, not necessarily agreement, but understanding, and then use that as a foundation to come up with third alternatives that are better that maybe have breakthroughs and break with how we've been doing it, and you have a breakthrough and do something differently and better because of it. What if the business could lead out and be a model of this kind of leadership to solve business challenges and give a model that says, hey, what if we could do this in society? And if we could learn to value the differences that we see, because we have so many differences, what if we could value the differences, show understanding, and listen to each other such that we can try to synergize and we can try to create alternatives and innovate so that we are creating something new and different and better that's not just a compromise where 1 + 1 = 1.5, but real synergy and creativity and innovation where 1 + 1 = 3 or 5 or 10 and you know, something more than just the sum of its parts. That's the opportunity in front of us. And I acknowledge it is difficult. I would say, I think we need organizations and businesses to lead out on this. And it could be schools that could lead out on this. And it could be a healthcare entity. It could be a not-for-profit that basically saying there's better ways of doing this that could be a model. And a model could then can become a mentor. And we need to see that in society at large. And so I would say, let's go inside out. Let's try to model it in our company.
Stephen is going to be bringing some tools with him that he will give to everyone who's at the event that will help to translate the theory into practice. He's got a deck of cards that summarizes the key learnings in his book. And that will make a lot of difference because organizations can meter these things out and say there's 50 cards there. If we take one a week and focus on changing our behaviors around this particular action, and then the next week we take a different card and grow that way. So Stephen is going to bring tools that go beyond just theory into how do we make this actionable in our society.
So let me get some more feedback. Jen in Rochester says, Evan, here's a good boss story. My boss is the best boss I've ever had, hands down. A born leader, effective and a constructive communicator, progressive thinker that embodies the whole person approach. Jen, I'm glad to hear it. That's great. We've been focused on what has to change. It sounds like you're in a very good situation, and I love hearing that. An anonymous email asks, what recommendations do you have for a frustrated workforce being led by a person who is inarguably no longer fit to serve? If internal change management efforts are at a standstill and there's no real mechanism for productive upward feedback, how might employees initiate change? Stephen?
I would just say this, go first. Be a model of the change you would like to see. Mm-hmm. Show them what it looks like. So if you want to see more respect in the culture, you model respect. You want to see more transparency, you model transparency. That's not a simple answer. It's difficult when that's your boss. And your boss is the problem. But again, if we think that the problem is out there, is the boss or everybody else, we're going to become disempowered if we only focus on that. I'm acknowledging that the boss could be the problem. But the way that we'll start to bring about change is that we go first within our circle of influence. We model that behavior. We create that transparency. We model the understanding. We extend the trust to our people, to those around us. And we're trying to show that there's a better way to lead. Now, not everyone will get it. And it may be that the boss doesn't change. But it's our best way forward is to help bring this about by modeling it ourselves, going first. The leader goes first, and it may be that your boss is not getting it, but you can show them what this looks like, how it could be done. That's not a satisfying answer in some ways, but it's probably the most realistic answer of trying to become a model who then can become a mentor.
Don wants to push back. He says, I'm afraid Mr. Covey has made up a leadership environment that doesn't exist so he can apply his approach and sell his books. Listen here, Don. So first of all, Don, I think what you might be saying is the leadership environment that doesn't exist, like the bad leadership, there's no way that is true. I hate to say this, Don, but just about everybody listening has had rough boss stories and uninspiring people in leadership. people who don't understand how to, I think, offer respect and trust to employees. That is definitely real. In fact, there have been interesting studies about why people with nonviolent psychopathy are more likely to end up in the corner office as a CEO. They're very good at dealing with the bottom line, and they don't have to worry about sort of who gets knocked down in the process. So, you know, sort of the financial managers love them. So that's definitely real. I don't know if what you're saying is his solutions are not real. I don't know, Stephen. Maybe he thinks that your pie-in-the-sky solutions are impossible. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I acknowledge that it's not easy. This is a simple approach where you model, you trust, you inspire, but it's not easy. But let me just give two quick illustrations of it in action. One is you look at Microsoft and what Satya Nadella has done under his leadership. When Satya Nadella came in, he was a trust and inspire leader. And Microsoft at the time was losing talent. They were not innovating. They were actually cutthroat in their culture, very competitive with each other, and really struggling, even though they were big and had all that market share and everything. Nadella comes in with a completely different style of leadership, where he had a growth mindset for everyone. He modeled the behavior by going first. He trusted and extended trust. They moved to a coaching model. He inspired through caring, but also through purpose, as Kathleen was saying, the why, identifying the why. And he literally helped transform Microsoft to where today they're a cloud powerhouse. They've completely reinvented themselves. They're a talent magnet, and they're winning in the workplace, winning the marketplace. Their stock price went from $36 to $280. But I'll give another illustration right in front of our eyes there in Rochester. Look at Wegmans Food Markets. Wonderful organization. I know they're not perfect. No one is. But it's a wonderful organization where they're winning in the marketplace with their customers. And they do that because they first win in the workplace with their own people. The kind of leadership that Danny Wegman, Kathleen Wegman and others are providing, it's really remarkable. Or Colleen Wegman, I'm sorry. Yep. Colleen Wegman. Is really quite remarkable, where they're one of the best companies to work for. They're on the 100 best companies list. To be on that list, you have to have high trust. It's actually 2/3 the criteria. They're at or near the top. And so what enables them to win in the marketplace with customers is because they first win in the workplace with their own people. So they are a real case example of being trust and inspire. Again, I'm not saying that they're perfect. No one is, but they're right there in front of our eyes, a great example of trust and inspire leadership. This is a better way to lead in our world. And we can shift and move into this kind of approach. And maybe the last thing I would just add is that don't view trust and inspire as soft or weak. You know, because sometimes people say, well, command and control is strong. Well, no, you know what? Trust and inspire is also strong. You can be strong without being forceful. As a trust and inspire leader, you can be authoritative without being authoritarian. You can be decisive without being autocratic. You can be in control without being controlling. This is a strong approach to leadership. You just do it through building the agreement and building a culture and building the relationship like they've done at Wegmans, and it changes everything.
Kathleen, are you an optimist that this can actually happen?
I see it every day. And it's a lot of what Stephen put out there in 2010 with Speed of Trust is what I bring into companies. I mean, trust is the foundation. Our trust ambassador, Bob Whipple, would tell you that every single day. I know what it means to go into an organization and work with toxic teams where there is no collaboration, there is that self-preservation, there's no psychological safety, and yet they are expected, especially if they're publicly traded, to return shareholder value. And how do you do that when people don't get along, they don't trust each other, and results are still imperative? So trust is the X factor.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, I feel the same way. I see it all the time. It's not an unusual thing. You just have to get the leaders to listen and to try these new methods, and the results are so remarkable. and the atmosphere in the companies, it just, it blows you away. And that's my life. I mean, that's my calling. That's my charter, my mission in life is to help leaders understand how they can get from where this miserable crunch all the time to outstanding performance, where leadership doesn't have to be terrible and awful. Leadership is a blast if you do it right.
Isn't that an amazing idea? Well, as we close here.
In fact, I'll just say this to Bob's point. Yeah. And Bob, by the way, is he's deserving of the title, the Trust Ambassador. He's superb, and his why is powerful. I will just say this, that if you think about the word inspire, it comes from the Latin word inspirare, which means to breathe life into. So here's what a trust and inspire approach to leadership does. It breathes life into relationships, into teams, into cultures. It becomes energizing, exciting, exhilarating, and we perform better. Whereas command and control tends to suck the life out of, and it's exhausting and no fun. So it's like a night and day different culture. And all three of us here, Kathleen, Bob, and I, would argue not only is the culture better, but the results and the outcomes you can produce are far better.
Kathleen, as we close here, what do you want the audience to know about what's coming up here?
Okay. On Tuesday, April 11th at the Convention Center, Stephen M. R. Covey is going to be here to address everybody on his newest leadership book, which is truly probably the defining leadership book of the 21st century. And I hope that everybody will join us. Go to rochesterrotary.org and you will find information to purchase tickets 12 to 1:30 that day. And you will be inspired.
And do it before Saturday.
I don't think you have to break people down to build them up. I think that you can lead in different ways at a lot of different levels. The book is Trust and Inspire. Stephen M. R. Covey, thank you, sir.
You're welcome, Evan. Thank you so much.
And our thanks to Bob Whipple, Kathleen Pringle. Thank you very much for being here this hour. Great having both of you. From the whole team at Connections, thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.